We're delighted to join in Dr. Bart's welcome to you for the Church State Symposium and introduce immediately our illustrious first speaker, the Honorable William L. Webster, Attorney General for the State of Missouri. As recorded in the program, he is a graduate of the University of Kansas and obtained his law degree from the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Prior to his election to this high office, he was in private practice in Joplin, Missouri, served 2 years in the General Assembly before he was elected at the age of 31 in 1984 as the Attorney General of his state. He has distinguished himself during these years by his emphasis on consumer protection, by his tough stance against career criminals, and by his efforts to reverse existing abortion laws, which gained national attention with last year's Supreme Court case of Webster versus Missouri Reproductive Services. Mr. Webster and his wife and family are members of Faith Lutheran Church in Jefferson City. Concordia recognized his distinguished and dedicated service at the 150th anniversary Founders Day celebration in December by extending to him the honorary degree of Doctor of Laws. The Honorable Dr. William Webster.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Spitz, thank you, and good morning. It's a pleasure to be back on your beautiful campus, especially on this spring day. For those of you that heard the weather last night, I didn't know whether we were going to wake up to snow or not, but the sun is shining, it's 45 degrees, and perhaps spring is with us after all. Perhaps the good weather will also facilitate you in moving the log structure, which is currently out on the flatbed truck today, as I understand it. This is a wonderful opportunity for me. Usually I'm speaking to civic groups in small towns in Missouri or groups of lawyers, and so this is a somewhat different forum, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here. My wife's family in particular has strong ties to this institution. Her grandfather was a graduate and served as a pastor for 50 years in South Dakota and in central Missouri, and it's a privilege to be back here today as you celebrate your 150th year of service in tradition and faith and excellence. The topic that I was given was one word, and in the letter that was sent, the request was, would you come and talk about abortion, period, one word. And I'm sure that there are people far more capable of discussing the topic, and that's sort of an open-ended issue, obviously, and a very controversial one. This morning, I pulled a set of public opinion polls from a couple of years ago on the topic, and it indicates just how fractured the American public is on this. Now, the sources of these polls are the Los Angeles Times, CBS News, and the New York Times, January 1989. So the polls, if not above repute, are at least from sources that are not likely to be skewed against the availability of abortion. When people were asked the question, do you believe abortion is morally right or wrong, the Los Angeles Times indicates 61% said morally wrong, 22% said morally right. When asked if you are in favor of abortion, the Los Angeles Times reported 43% opposed, 37% favor, 20% indifferent. That's an interesting category. When asked if a woman wants to have an abortion and her doctor agrees, should it be available, 63% say yes, 26% say no. And then the very same survey said, do you agree or disagree with the statement, abortion is murder? Los Angeles Times, March 3, 1989, 40% no, 60% yes. Now, how we reconcile the fact that we have such a diversity of opinion, and what it really underscores is that it has a lot to do with how you ask the question. If you ask people if you think it should be available, if there should be a right to choose, you get one set of responses. If you ask the very same people, do you believe abortion should be available for gender selection or for convenience, you are likely to get that same 70 to 80% that reach an absolutely contrary position. And so what it ultimately reflects is that the American people are very torn on this question. If anything, the divisiveness has substantially increased in the last few years. The controversy really began in earnest, or at least the first major round, in 1973 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Roe versus Wade. There were two holdings that were central to Roe versus Wade. The first, that the 14th Amendment guarantee of liberty includes a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy. That's what Roe said. The second ruling was that the state has an interest in regulating abortion and prohibiting abortion when the fetus becomes viable. Viability meaning when the fetus can survive outside of the womb. And so from the very beginning, the Roe decision, which was a 7-2 decision, set up two competing interests. The rights of the woman, a liberty interest under the 14th Amendment, which is often called substantive due process, and that right of that viable fetus. They did not call it a person. In fact, personhood was denied until viability. There were two very strong dissents in that decision. The dissent in Roe versus Wade was authored by Justice White, who was vehement in suggesting that the court was wandering off into territory which was not authorized by the Constitution of the United States. He said, "I find nothing, absolutely nothing, in the language or the history of the Constitution of the United States to support the court's judgment. The court simply fashions and announces a new constitutional right for pregnant mothers with scarcely any reason or authority for its action. It invests that right with sufficient substance so as to override virtually every existing state abortion statute. The upshot is that the people and the legislatures of the 50 states are constitutionally disentitled to weigh the relative importance of the continued existence and development of the fetus on the one hand against a spectrum of possible impacts on the mother on the other. It is an exercise of raw judicial power. The court perhaps has authority to do it, but in my judgment, it is an imprudent and extravagant exercise of power of judicial review that this court extends." Now, that was in 1973. There were two lone votes. Justice Bork, in his recent book, which is now on the bestsellers list, you may have seen it, I commend it to you, indicates that this language in Roe was not so much found in the Constitution as literally forced upon the Constitution. And that's an important distinction. And at the risk of getting a little too legalistic today, the words involving privacy in particular are not found in the Constitution. They are found in what are called the penumbras. Now, that's not a word you probably use over the dinner table, but the Supreme Court said, hidden in the penumbras, which in lay language represent the crevices, the cracks, those corridors which cannot be seen, that which is implicit in the Constitution. And many of you sometimes find people who would like to find penumbras in the gospel, which are probably not there, but much the same, they found penumbras in the Constitution, and they said it is certainly implied that this right is there. And this raises the question, how do you find a penumbra? How do you decide when something was there and the framers meant it, they just didn't get around to putting it down explicitly? And so the court, early in this century, the U.S. Supreme Court, created something called substantive due process under the 14th Amendment. And that basically said they were going to look at state regulation. They were going to determine if it essentially violated that which is implicit in the Constitution of our country. And so the question became, how do you determine if something is in fact implicit in the Constitution, and thus the states will not be able to regulate it? And the court came up with the concept of calling something a fundamental right. Now, we have lots of rights, but we have very few rights which are afforded fundamental status and protection. The freedom of speech is a fundamental right. The freedom of religion is a fundamental right, specifically enumerated in the Constitution. But the words to the right of privacy and certainly right of abortion do not appear as fundamental rights expressly in the Constitution of the United States, and at least not in the normal textual responses that are applied when you're looking to interpret the Constitution. So the court in the early part of this century, about 1920, adopted the notion that if something could be proven to be deeply rooted in American history or tradition or implicit in the notion of ordered liberty, it would become a fundamental right, and thus any state attempt to regulate that fundamental right would be subject to strict scrutiny and would in all likelihood be struck down because it is virtually impossible for a state regulation to survive that strict scrutiny standard. That's why our freedom of speech under the First Amendment is so broad, because any effort on the part of a state or a locality to abridge freedom of speech is going to be subject to strict scrutiny. And once something becomes a fundamental right, essentially, the horse is out of the barn. And so that was the fiction that was applied in 1973. And what we argued, among other things, to the U.S. Supreme Court is that in 1973, by no stretch of the imagination could it be argued that conduct, abortion in this case, which was illegal in over half the states, and which had historically been illegal for the most part since our country was founded, in many jurisdictions, could be considered a broad, universal, fundamental right, which was part of the tradition of our country. There are some cultures where it was part of the tradition, but it was a stretch of history to imply that it was part of our culture. The irony is that while the court may well have been wrong, we argued they were, in their view of finding this fundamental right out of the mist, out of the penumbras in 1973, that because of the 20-some million abortions that have been performed since 1973, lawyers might well argue that today it is a pervasive part of our culture, and it is now taken as a fundamental right, and that was the challenge that the court faced. The first harbinger that this new, and I might call it the Rehnquist Court, because it was substantially different than the court that ruled in Roe versus Wade and its composition, would be willing to take a more restrictive view of this concept of finding fundamental rights that are not specifically denominated in the Constitution, was a couple of years ago in a case called Bowers versus Hardwick. It was the sodomy law in Georgia. And a very prominent professor, Lawrence Tribe from Harvard Law School, who's an author of one of the very widely used constitutional law treatises, defended the defendants in that case, attempting to strike down the Georgia sodomy law. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, ruled that the only way to strike down this law is for us to find that sodomy is a fundamental right. And the only way to find that it's a fundamental right is to find that it is deeply rooted in the traditions of our country and that it is part of our notion of ordered liberty. And if you read the Federalist Papers or you go back and look at history, you're hard-pressed to find anywhere that was part of the fundamental notion of our country. And the court said it just isn't there. It's up to the states. It's not up to us to create a right, even though societal norms have shifted. We cannot find that which just isn't there. And that was a signal, at least to us, that the new court, with Justices Scalia and Justice Kennedy, Justice O'Connor, along with the two original dissents in Roe, Justice White and Justice Rehnquist, would take what we would call a more traditional view of the original intent of the framers of the Constitution and a less expansive notion of finding fundamental rights out in the mist. And so with that, the legislature of the state of Missouri in 1986 passed what was arguably the narrowest of the abortion statutes that were pending on appeal before the Supreme Court at the time. There were appeals from Illinois, Ohio, Minnesota, and Missouri. And our law was, frankly, rather narrow. It said that in Missouri, taxpayers should not be compelled to pay for abortion or use public facilities to provide those procedures. This was not a revolutionary statement, since, to my knowledge, the state has never paid for one. So they were essentially saying, not only have we never paid for one, but we don't plan to in the future. Not in and of itself a dramatic step. As far as public procedures, the year before this case went to the Supreme Court, there were only 50 abortions in a state hospital. That was the University of Missouri Columbia Medical Center. So it did not affect a dramatic number of procedures. Finally, it said, it made a philosophical statement that life begins at conception, and the Supreme Court said a state is entitled to adopt that philosophical statement. So that was the framework of the case. The day after the legislature passed that bill and the governor signed it, I was sued personally. My name was put on the case by the plaintiffs who sued me to enjoin the state from enforcing this arguably very innocuous statement of philosophy of the legislature, because it did not have a great impact on the number of procedures, but it did state we have the right to take these positions. And it was also designed in part to create an opportunity for the U.S. Supreme Court to revisit the subject. It was immediately struck down by the district court. There were 18 sections to this law. Everyone was struck down after hearing as facially unconstitutional. That means that just looking at it, before the state even suggests how they intend to enforce this law, it's unconstitutional, because any state regulation is subject to this so-called strict scrutiny. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals that represents Missouri, among other Midwestern states, ruled that it was not entirely unconstitutional. They only struck down 17 of the 18 sections. They upheld one. And so it was with that framework that we appealed to the United States Supreme Court. Much of the press was very hostile. They said, how dare the state of Missouri and the Attorney General's office defend a clearly unconstitutional statute. I recall meeting with many members of the press and saying, well, you may not like the statute, but we certainly feel it's within the boundaries of the Constitution, and we're entitled to go forward in good faith to the U.S. Supreme Court to find out. And that is what happened last year. I don't believe anybody who drafted this law expected the maelstrom of activity that occurred when the U.S. Supreme Court began to suggest that they might take this case. It was in the context of October 1988, which you may recall is a few weeks before the presidential election. And so it started to creep into the national debate. There was a question after President Bush was elected as to what position he would take. The U.S. Solicitor General's office was being encouraged by President Reagan to write a brief in support of Missouri's position. That administration was on the way out, however, And so there was a fight in the Justice Department between those that wanted the United States to take a position consistent with that which they had taken in the Thornburg case in 1986 in defense of the state's rights to regulate, and a group that said, we don't want to do anything controversial. And so what evolved was a 10-page, innocuous, milquetoast statement from the Justice Department, which came out the day before Thanksgiving, which said, if you want to talk about it, this was the brief they filed to the Supreme Court, and they said, if you want to talk about abortion, the Missouri case is free of procedural defects, which is not exactly a rousing endorsement. It's out there, and if you could, but it was not a ringing endorsement, but it wasn't a denunciation. It was a very safe, innocuous position. Notwithstanding that, the next day, banner headlines, USA Today, Justice Department urges court to take case, which indicated to me that, if nothing else, USA Today had certainly not read that very short brief. They brought new meaning to the word brief in what they suggested. The court did take the case. It takes four justices for the United States Supreme Court to take a case, and four justices emerged which obviously felt that, I have a feeling I know who the four were, who felt that it was appropriate to revisit this subject. And we did. The last day that the court could hear cases, April 26th, of last year. They ruled the week before they heard the case. There were protests. Over 300,000 people marched in Washington, basically in a position contrary to that of the state. Over 150,000 people massed in favor. There were more briefs filed on this case than any case in the history of the United States Supreme Court. More support briefs. One I would mention, which was filed by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on behalf of the state's position, along with the Archdiocese of St. Louis and a number of other religious organizations. There were a number of church organizations that filed briefs on behalf of those that opposed the state statute. The upshot of that is that the U.S. Supreme Court has recently adopted a rule basically limiting and really seeking to almost prohibit the filing of amicus briefs because there were so many, they were so inundated, that they just said, if we're going to get 40 briefs on every case, we'll never get anything done. But in this case, there was a great great deal of interest. We argued the case, and on July 3rd, the Supreme Court ruled. Now, what they said was, again, one of those things that was lost in the hype of the occasion. Basically, four justices suggested there should be no state regulation whatsoever, and that abortion on demand is the law of the land. Four more justices suggested that a significant degree of state regulation is appropriate. Justice Scalia suggested that that Roe was just flawed, there was no fundamental right to abortion, that they will have to revisit this again and again, and they ought to just return the football to the states. And that left one swing vote, Justice O'Connor, who said, I don't have to go back and decide today whether Roe versus Wade was right, because I can uphold the Missouri law without ever talking about it, because it is a reasonable regulation and it is within the bounds of the Constitution. So we had a 5-4 plurality in this case. Now that's the legal significance of it. What has unfolded since, I think, is frankly much more significant. You can look at this issue on a couple of levels. I guess the first is the legal level, and the court said it's now up to the legislatures, and legislatures for 20-some years have been saying it is our prerogative. Every year the Missouri legislature overwhelmingly passed laws, as did states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, Minnesota. Many of the Midwestern and industrial states in particular. California, New York had taken an absolutely contrary view. They had basically, by statute, authorized abortion in virtually any scenario, at least until the third trimester. So you had politicians that said, it's up to us. And the court, I think with no small degree of mischief, finally reached the conclusion, you know, these folks have been asking for it since 1973. We're going to see how serious they really are. And I think that's the more enlightening aspect of the debate, and that is what has happened in the intervening months since last July, when the Supreme Court placed this as an option back in the hands of the legislatures of this country. There had been those who had time and time again said, taken a very vociferous position when they felt that their results didn't mean very much. We are now faced with a situation where the acts of legislators now have the potential to have a meaningful impact on the availability of abortion. And the results have been very telling. In the state of Missouri, for instance, the Missouri legislature, through the leadership, has taken the position this is a very controversial issue and one which we really shouldn't be discussing this year because it takes time away from other issues. So there has been, I think, a rather substantial retreat. There have been three states that have moved forward, or actually two states and a territory. The first state was Pennsylvania, historically a leader in legislating regulation in this area, and that bill was passed very quickly. The second territory was Guam, and in Guam they recently passed the most restrictive language in the area of abortion. They said that if you have an abortion or if you assist, it will be a misdemeanor, and if you perform it, it will be a felony. And that's broader than most states have ever suggested they would go. Finally, you had Idaho. That was a bill that was passed by both legislatures, and after innumerable debates, protests, and threats to boycott Idaho potatoes, among other things, last week, the governor of Idaho vetoed the Idaho legislation. And so what we have had is frankly fascinating. We have had the Supreme Court give the legislatures what approximately half of them have been clamoring for 17 years, the right under the Constitution to consider what sorts of regulations they will have, whether it involves parental consent, whether it involves limitations to funding and use of public facilities, whether it involves a stronger informed consent for the physician, and a handful of states that have suggested prohibiting abortion except to protect the life or health of the mother, which was essentially the Guam position and the Idaho position. And what has happened now that that responsibility has been returned is that very few states have the will or the resolve to go forward. The American public is absolutely fractured on the issue, but legally the ball is now in the state court. That is the upshot, the impact of this case, and my guess is that the political landscape will be dominated by this issue, at least in part, for a number of years, and it tends, I fear, to obscure the greater issue. And that's where I am personally pleased with this denomination. And that is the fact that it really may not be a problem that ultimately lends itself to the political process because the American people are so fractured, depending on how you ask the question. The truth of the matter is it hasn't affected most of those people that have answered those polls, and it may well be that ultimately this is a fight that has to be waged in a far different forum. That same set of polls, and it came from the American Enterprise Institute, the same group, Ben Wattenberg and his organization that analyzed these issues, suggested that the fight has been led most vociferously through religious organizations, and that ultimately this may be a discussion that lends itself as a moral issue, rather than just the 10th Amendment of the Constitution and those prerogatives which are reserved for the states. I tend to view it on that level, and also I think as a signal of where we're headed as a society, because I think abortion is as much a reflection, certainly the number of procedures that are performed, as a number of other signals come forward, and that has to do with responsibility. We have a society today where often people are willing to avoid individual responsibility, seek to blame government, seek to blame society, seek to blame someone else for their problems, and seek refuge in drugs. And abortion is another signal that tends to move away from individual responsibility and the kinds of signals that we send. One of the messages that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, I think, has stood very firm on is the message of individual responsibility and accountability in the area of abortion. It is ultimately a moral issue, and it is ultimately an issue where I believe we have a strong responsibility to communicate with those around us. Those of you with pulpits in particular, I believe, have a unique opportunity to discuss the moral implications, not that which you do because government tells you you must do it or you shouldn't do it, but rather what you do because it is right or wrong. And abortion in particular is an issue that I believe needs to be discussed. The Lutheran Witness has had a number of, I think, very timely discussions of the church's position, but I think it goes beyond that. As a society today, roughly one out of three pregnancies ends in abortion. That is a staggering statistic, and one that I think we will ultimately be held accountable for as a society. And so I would like to tell you definitively what has happened in the last few years in and of itself will change the debate or will dramatically reduce the number of abortions. I think what has ultimately happened, however, is different than what many people had expected. I think it has underscored the shallowness of resolve, in particular on the part of a lot of people in public life who had taken votes on the issue when they were questioned and said, well, I'm for something or against something. But when the vote took on significance, they said, we don't really want to talk about that anymore. And so the issue is not going to go away. The Congress of the United States doesn't want to talk about it, and most state legislatures as well are not going to talk about it. So that means we are either going to have silence or there are going to be those individuals in a position of moral authority and spiritual authority that are willing to stand up and talk about the issue on that basis. And that is the challenge that many of you who are students at this seminary will face as you try and sort out for yourselves where you must be on this very controversial subject. There's one other challenge that we face, and that is that the subject of abortion has, I fear, become something of a metaphor for the role of the woman in society today. I've gone through any number of factories and businesses, and as I talk to people, and a lot of them bring up this subject, they say, you know, I don't want an abortion, I would never have one, but I don't like people telling me what I can and cannot do. And part of that is the character of the American nature, not that abortion is implicit in ordered liberty, but I think it's part of our society today, as we reach the end of the 20th century, that there is a frustration, and that this whole debate has something to do with the role of gender and the role of women in society, and that the poll statistics you see are a reflection of that very unique frustration which is out there, and that poses a very real challenge for our denomination as well. It has been a unique privilege as we consider this entire subject to be at least an historical footnote. I went to a law school recently. I was recruiting new lawyers, and in three different classrooms they were talking about this case and what it meant. We have had pickets, we have had death threats, we have had people who thanked us for stopping all the abortions, and I tell them that in truth we may deserve neither the praise nor the enmity, because what we succeeded in doing, I think, was moving closer to the original intent of the Constitution, which was placing this area of responsibility at the state level, which is what I think the 10th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States provides. That provides an opportunity, but it is an opportunity which for the last approximately 12 months has gone absolutely unanswered. So it now becomes a battleground of American opinion, people who are educated about the very real dynamics and the nature, and I think most importantly, the scope of the problem. When you hear about subjects such as rape and incest, most people are very sympathetic to those situations which are used as justification, but those represent a very small percentage indeed, something between 1% and 2%, and it obscures the larger fact, one out of every three pregnancies, millions and millions of what the Supreme Court now has placed in legal limbo, fetuses, unviable fetuses, which are terminated. A very real challenge for our state, our nation, our culture, and our denomination, indeed, in these difficult times. You are probably the people who should be talking about this issue more than the Attorney General, because I am bound by the laws of the state, and that's what I must defend, and those are the parameters which define the role I can take. You, on the other hand, have the freedom of speech and a forum and the opportunity to decide for yourselves where you should be, where our church should be, and frankly, where your parishioners should be. And I encourage you not to look away, as so many legislators are now doing, but rather to acknowledge forthrightly that this is a reality, that it is part of our culture, and we have to decide whether it's a part of our culture which is healthy and appropriate. I think not personally, but I challenge you to focus in on that as we deal with the issue. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you as you celebrate this. You have a wonderful program, and I look forward to spending a couple more hours with you and wish you a very successful day. Thank you.
We have a half an hour for questions. I assume the microphones on the floor are open. If anyone has a question, we invite you to come to the microphone and to address the Attorney General, and we'll call you in sequence.
Mr. Webster?
Can you hear me?
Yes, Alex.
It's understandable that people will argue the legal aspects of abortion, but is that an excuse for a basis for silence among Christians and even support of abortion rights? Should abortion, for convenience, be classified as sinful and doctrinal rather than just a policy statement, as occurred in my congregation?
Well, of course, one of the things that we believe in is strong autonomy among congregations, so it's not for me to tell you what your congregation should or should not do. On a larger level, I will tell you that the religious organizations on a variety of spectrums have been drawn in and into this discussion. Some organizations in particular fear that it has become, and I might point out some of the national Jewish organizations that filed briefs on the other side of the case, and I've communicated with them a great deal, and many of the briefs fear the issue, I think, not just for the substance of the availability of abortion, but because they fear that it represents one religious point of view which is attempting to be forced upon them. And so there is a perception out there among a number of denominations, they happen to be very vocal on the subject, but a number of denominations that have taken the position that the abortion debate is being used to force a doctrine on them, whether it is a Catholic doctrine. That was actually raised in one brief, and Justice Stevens, in his dissent in the abortion case, said, under what's called the Establishment Clause, which is the separation of church and state, which is very relevant in this discussion, he said that the notion that life begins at conception is nothing more than a veiled attempt on the state to impose a denomination's religious belief, and therefore it should be struck down on the First Amendment, on the Establishment Clause. The majority of the court rejected that, but there is a strong sentiment among some denominations out there that this is really just a handful of certain denominations that are attempting to impose their beliefs. And that's the very real fine line that should be the focus, I think, of these 2 days, and that is, what can we do within the concept of separation in church and state to express positions which have a moral basis? Does it mean that we have an obligation to be silenced as Christians because we take positions on challenging issues? And I don't believe that the Constitution requires that. I think the framers would be somewhat overwhelmed if they heard the arguments that are used today, usually by organizations that have an absolutely different point of view on the underlying issue, to say, you don't have a right as an organized group to stand up and take a voice, or as individuals to stand up and take a voice and say, we think this is wrong, whether it is gambling or pornography or abortion, the whole gamut of crimes that have heretofore been categorized as victimless. And that's, I think, a lot of us, particularly denominations that have historically been somewhat more insular and less active in these issues, the challenge we face is to say, we're not trying to dictate, we are trying to at least advise you that we believe moral issues are important, and we have a right to tell you what our position is. And that's an important, I think it's important that we do that. For too long, I believe people with what I would call a strong belief in certain values have been silent, and that silence has allowed those with a more secular humanist view of the world to dictate the agenda. And I believe it's important that we at least be involved and let people know what we think. It doesn't mean that I attempt to, for instance, impose my beliefs. I have them. It means that I defend the law. I was recently interviewed by a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and he asked me what I thought about abortion, and I told him, but I said, you misunderstand my role. As Attorney General, if the legislature had passed a law requiring that we pay for every abortion, I would have defended it, because that's the oath I took. I would have held my nose, but I would have defended it. But you, as an individual, have an entirely different role. You know, you don't have to defend the laws of the state. You're entitled to stand up if you disagree with them, contact your legislators, and speak out. And I think that's a responsibility we have.
I agree with the Senate position on abortion, but my question is, are our congregational members, our brothers, are they trying to use it ourselves? And I find a weakness in that we don't get the support from our members to take issue with the abortion problem. Thank you.
Well, I'm probably not the best person to answer that. I'll refer you to Dr. Bowman, but my experience has been that this is a very that this is a difficult issue for congregations in our denomination, and that for you can go into any given community and there may be one particular congregation that is very energized on this issue, and there will be another that really just doesn't want to tackle that. You know, there are too many other problems out there, and why get one that makes people mad? In my home community, I think one of the congregations tends to talk a little bit more about this in the sermons than the other. That also has something to do probably with the interest of the individual pastor in that issue, if we're going to be candid about it. Yes?
At the same microphone, ma'am, you're standing.
All right. It is a moral issue, but since it is perceived by many as a right or a political issue, would it make a difference in the polls if they were rightly asked the hard question, do you believe it is a right to pass a law which permits one portion of our citizenship to have the permission and the right, even the to commit murder against citizens who have the constitutional right for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? This is assuming that they have already decided that life begins at conception. Then these infants that are not yet born are citizens who have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Can that be taken away by one segment of our society? And if so, then how is the term murder to be defined and or applied to the taking of another person's life in any part of our society? Can men as well as women also claim that right? And then aside from that, you mentioned about demonstrations influencing. Do demonstrations bear influence on the outcome of justice decisions? And if so, can justice, real justice, be served?
Well, Art Fleming on Jeopardy would say that's about a six-part question.
Yeah.
Probably. First of all, I cannot tell you how people would respond to that question.
I've never heard that question put that way, though.
The truth of the matter is, the pollsters would probably say it's too long a question, and I'm being sincere, and that therefore it's impossible for the respondent to ask, and that's why they ask it in shorter. Do you favor? Should it be available?
Should
you
women
know,
have
what
the
do you
right
think
to
about
commit
it?
Murder?
And depending on how you ask it, you get absolutely converse positions. The bottom line is, every indication we've seen is that the American public really doesn't like abortion very much, but that they think in a percentage slightly over 50% in our state, for instance, that it should be available as an option in certain circumstances. And no matter how the question is answered, that's generally the response that comes through. As far as do protests and rallies and letters influence the court, I think the truth of the matter is no, not very much, not the United States Supreme Court. The mail, and I talked a lot with clerks up there and with their information people. I know thousands of petitions and letters were written. I guess part of it depends on who writes the letter, but the truth of the matter is there are mail carts. The mail, for the most part, was never touched, was never opened during this debate. Justice Scalia, in his dissent, said we don't want to have another case. We ought to just go ahead and get rid of abortion now because we don't want to have another case where we have carts of mail stacking up. You know, I don't think he was being glib. I think he was saying quit dodging the issue, and that seemed to be a directive to Justice O'Connor, who didn't want to talk about the issue in this case. I think the protests and the expressions of public sentiment do have a great deal more influence on the elected officials. As again, I refer back to Justice Scalia because he tends to be the most prosaic in his words on the issue. But he said this, when discussing issues, he said, this is one that better lends itself to duly elected representatives of the people rather than life-tenured, unelected federal judges who are essentially unaccountable. I guess the result of that is that if you're unaccountable and if you're there forever, you are less likely to be swayed by mail or picketers or protests. Conversely, I think it suggests that people in public life who do run for office and who do place themselves before the people in the democratic process are much more likely to be swayed by that. The media plays a role in that and how they've shaped the issue and how they've covered the issue, but I think it's safe to say that a lot of states and a lot of legislatures have run away from the issue precisely because it's controversial, and most people want to be associated with issues like motherhood and apple pie where 90% agree. And so I think they've run totally sideways on the issue.
Would the issue be so divided, though, if they would perceive this as murder rather than just free choice?
I can't answer that for you. Because you mean the legislature or the public?
No, the public. Even women who are for free choice, if they understood that this was the right to commit murder, would they be for that?
Well, I think the abstract, it's much easier to be something for something in the abstract than when you have to come to grips with it. And I always personally tend to place great credence in those people that used to run abortion clinics, for instance, and then they started to realize the magnitude of what they were doing, and you've seen those films and those reports. Some legislators are obviously have been affected by that. Some will not. That you have asked one of the imponderables, but I think
But you never hear it out in the news.
I think it's much more likely to happen if you seek to educate them than if you're silent.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
The other microphone.
Yes. You said something to the effect it has resolved the shallowness of the... No, it has underscored the shallowness of the resolve on the part of many people in regards to abortion. And legislators and other public officials have taken the position, I don't want to talk about it. And I think that's true. But I think as Christians, we have an obligation to force them to talk about it. In Ecclesiastes, it says there's a time to speak and a time to remain silent. And it's time for Christians to speak. If Christian people were coerced into silence because their representative or senator in the state legislature says, I don't want to talk about it, is it likely that other people will speak out on this issue? And I want to speak on one other thing. You said this one Supreme Court justice stated that, in his view, the churches were trying to impose their religious views on society.
Justice Stevens.
Yeah.
Yes.
But evidently they see nothing wrong with the immoral people trying to impose their views on society. And when there are important issues, there are going to be many people from many facets of society trying to make their views prevail. And why is it wrong for church people to try to make their views prevail, but it's all right for everybody else? It seems like this is an attempt to deny freedom of speech. But I'm mostly concerned about the church people remaining silent. Could you comment on that, please?
Well, I don't think that you and I would disagree on that. I think my point was that now that the ball has been placed back in the court of those that are elected, many of those individuals don't want to face the issue. Now that means the electorate has an option if they, depending on their point of view, whether they hold them accountable for that position. And I can't tell other people what they should do in that regard, but they have that opportunity, and that's one that they didn't have before because it was being dictated by justices that were not subject to accountability or election. And I think that's the point. As far as speaking up, history is replete with times of moral crisis when good people did nothing, and we have paid the price for that.
Mr. Webster, I read recently an article in Time magazine concerning the right to die and mm-hmm. Nancy Cruzan, and you were quoted in there, or they talked about your role in bringing forth before the Missouri legislature some sort of criteria for deciding these things. I wonder if you would comment about that case and how it relates legally to abortion and the legal ramifications. Are there
sure.
some...
It's a very difficult... Very difficult issue, I think, in many, it is a distinct issue. First of all, this is a, while there is a case at the Supreme Court, there is no law, there is no legislation in the state of Missouri heretofore. There was a blank page. And so a judge in my home county of Jasper County, Missouri, Judge Teal, ruled that Nancy Cruzan had expressed her desire not to be kept alive by extraordinary means or not to be kept alive if she were to be crass in a vegetative state. The law of Missouri, as recently articulated by the Supreme Court, is that we have the right, everybody in this room, everybody in this state has the right to refuse medical treatment when they're competent. Some people don't like that, but that is if you will, a fundamental right in this state, and every state that has considered it, not the Supreme Court, but every state that's considered it either legislatively or as a matter of policy, has said that I have the right to say when I'm competent that I, no more, don't put me on the respirator, let nature take its course, or if I'm a terminal patient and I have terminal cancer and the treatments might prolong me for another 2 weeks, say, let go. And that is now our right in Missouri. It has arguably always been our right. It just had never been litigated, but that's what hospitals always did, and hospitals and families and individuals made these decisions. What happened in this case, and the challenge that we face, is that we have a patient who is incompetent because she was thrown from a car, landed on her head, never woke up, her brain is primarily water, that there is virtually no, and I say virtually no likelihood, no patient in her condition has ever recovered after more than 19 months. She's been in a coma for 7 years, over 100,000 patients have been examined in this condition, none have ever recovered, and so there is a, from a medical certainty, the odds of saying this patient is ever going to, quote, wake up is nil. So then the question becomes, how does a person who is incompetent express their desire to refuse treatment? And that's what the debate is all about. The family presented anecdotal evidence that she would not want to be kept alive. One involved, and I'm sorry for long, but it's a very complicated issue, and it's probably going to come down in the next 2 weeks from the Supreme Court. One of her sources of anecdotal evidence was that she had just seen a friend that had a miscarriage, and she had a statement about how much she disliked hospitals. Most people do. But and then there was another statement about how she wouldn't want to be kept, I think, on tubes or something. But the Missouri Supreme Court said, unless you have something in writing, we're going to require clear and convincing evidence before we take you off of the medical treatment, that that's what you wanted. We're going to require that you prove to us that you exercised your right to refuse treatment when you were competent. So essentially, that's the position of the Supreme Court. I defended that. The family appealed for the proposition that the Supreme Court of the United States should find hidden in the penumbras of the Constitution a new fundamental right of surrogate decision makers. And it is very seductive for someone to say, because who's better to make the decision? You, the family member, or some judge, some cold, callous, uncaring judge? And I think the initial response is, well, of course, the family member. But there's no constitutional basis for that. Probate laws have historically been left up to the states, and guardianship codes have always been a creature of the states. And so we have said, no, there's no fundamental federal right here. And if you go down that path, it's very dangerous because not all family members, as much as we would like them to be, are well motivated. You may have a nephew out there who said, Uncle Harry's filthy rich, and I don't think he'd want to be kept alive like that, so I'm going to go, and I'm the heir, so I'm going to go make the decision and buy my new Porsche. You know, I mean, it happens. I mean, there is malevolence in this world. And so the question is, how do we protect the integrity of the patient's wishes? Because I fully believe, and history may prove me wrong in 14 days, but I fully believe that the Supreme Court is going to say, based on what they said in the abortion case and the sodomy case, there is no federal right of substituted judgment, because that's what they have to find, that I have hereby substituted judgment for somebody else, even though I didn't delegate it to you in writing. And so what we recommended is that the probate code of Missouri be amended so that there is a procedure which is established which says a patient would have to be in a persistent vegetative state for 3 years, which is longer than anyone has ever recovered, and that there would have to be 3 physicians come forward and testify that there was no likelihood of recovery, that the patient would feel no pain, and most importantly, that there was some substantial evidence that the patient desired to refuse treatment, which is much narrower than any other state, but it acknowledges that we have a problem and that the courts aren't very well equipped to deal with it. The flip side is that with the Missouri statute alone, what will happen is that a family member will go to a lawyer in Clayton or wherever, the city, and the lawyer will tell them, I want to tell you the law in Missouri before you proceed. If you tell me that your mother said she wouldn't want to be kept alive as a vegetable and she was very clear, then I'll tell you the law is her wish can be carried out. If you tell me she didn't say anything, I'll tell you she'll remain in that condition forever. Now, what did she say? So in essence, I mean, I'm sincere. In essence, patients or clients will be advised in advance hypothetically, to lie, to achieve the result they want. And I don't think that protects the patient, and that's why I recommended a change to the probate code. But how does it relate to abortion? Only peripherally, in that the family initially argued that there is a fundamental right to privacy that extends to this area. I will tell you, after the abortion decision, they abandoned that position and went off into invasions of, like taking blood samples and invasions of bodily premises.
Well, you tell me what I want to know, because, in other words, the legal battle is basically the privacy issue. Is it not?
Not anymore.
Anymore, but
no,
I mean
That's where it started, but now the case has very little to do with it. The legislation I was recommending, I think we have to acknowledge that patients are in this condition, and if they truly had expressed wishes, there ought to be a mechanism to carry it out with the family notified, with medical diagnosis, but with some court there somewhere to make sure that this is really what the patient wanted rather than what somebody wants who desires to get to the house or the money or wants to bump them off. And it has great implications for people with degenerative senility or Alzheimer's. I mean, we want to draw a line because it's a very slippery slope. You go down towards, abortions at one end of the spectrum, this is the other. And I think there have to be procedural safeguards because some courts of states have just gone off the bend and you're going to move very quickly towards euthanasia if you're not careful.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Mr. Webster, I'm still a little unclear as to why the Supreme Court will not address this question of when personhood begins, or why they won't engage in the debate over this distinction between viability and non-viability of the fetus. It seems to me that that's at the heart of the issue. What is this that's in the mother's womb? And I get the sense that the Supreme Court does not want to address the question at all.
I think you're probably right, and Again, I can only say, without trying to sound too glib, I'm not the person that can tell you why the Supreme Court doesn't want to address it. I can tell you, I believe, fundamentally, there are three justices that do want to address it. And those justices are Justice Scalia, Justice White, and Justice Rehnquist. Justice Kennedy has not been as clear, although he seems to be a fellow traveler. If you go back to Roe, essentially they set up this notion of viability, and that is being able to survive outside of the womb. When Roe came about, medical technology was such, 28 weeks was about the point. And before 28 weeks of age, gestational age, that fetus couldn't survive. And so they said, well, the state doesn't have an interest till then because the fetus can't survive. And that's that artificial trimester framework they adopted. When Sandra O'Connor joined the court, the first case she faced of significance in the area was called Akron, the Akron versus Reproductive Health Services case, same last name. And in that case, she said, you know, this whole trimester framework is flawed because now it's tied to medical technology, and medical technology is moving. At that time, viability was 24 weeks. In our case, it was stipulated by the parties that viability had moved back to 20 weeks. So tying it to this rigid medical framework just was obsolete. And so the court started to acknowledge that and seemed to suggest that the framework was a little flawed, at least as to trimesters. As far as viability is concerned, Justice White from day one said, whatever it is something. And it is something that is to be afforded protection, and these distinctions are artificial and cannot be found in the Constitution. And you sense that Scalia has adopted the same position. I do commend Justice Bork's book to you for his analysis of the whole way that the privacy concept has grown, because he points out that Justice Blackmun travels nationally as the author of his progenitor of Roe, and that's why he was so strong about the cold wind blowing across the land. He has a great proprietary sense, and he points out that Blackmun believes very strongly that this is a moral issue on the other side, and that tends to obscure the legal arguments that ought to be found in the Constitution. But it's a long-winded answer to tell you I can't say why the Supreme Court hasn't addressed it. We told them in our brief our position was that there should be no distinction. And we commended to them, and the U.S. Solicitor General ultimately did, notwithstanding their lukewarm response once they got into it, and once George Bush stood on the steps of the U.S. Capitol and took a strong position, the Justice Department found renewed vigor. Thornburg didn't want to argue it, so they hired Charles Freed, who was a Harvard professor who had been the Solicitor General under Reagan, to come back, and he argued that. And that was one of the things he and I talked about at length, was that the distinctions on viability are becoming more and more meaningless. And that was placed before the court. Ultimately, they said, we can decide the Missouri case without ever having to reach it. And they tried to reach as narrow a result as possible. That's why the Idaho statute, the Guam statute, were crafted essentially to force them to ultimately, as Justice Scalia said, come to face reality and come to grips with the issue.
What did they say in response to our preamble that says life begins at conception? Did they say something to that?
They said the state has the right to adopt the preamble, and that it would not be struck down as facially unconstitutional, that if the state attempted to apply that preamble to abortion regulation, that it might be subject to additional review, but that it was not on its face unconstitutional. And that's the problem that we had historically had. It was struck down just as unconstitutional on its face, any substantial regulation of abortion. So they at least left the door open.
One more.
Bill Heck, I think it's very meaningful that this discussion is taking place in a church-state symposium, because moving to the political side, and I don't know how many people realize what a potential Pandora's box that we have here on the whole thing. reading the stuff that I read in Washington, most analysts are suggesting that on the national level, the Democrats are making no place for pro-lifers in their long-term program. About a month ago, I attended a seminar in Princeton, New Jersey, where the majority of the Republican House of Representative members were there talking about the Congress of the 90s. And as they went over issue after issue, one of the things they had was all the great pollsters and the political analysts, and almost to a person, as they went over the domestic issues, the foreign policy issues, they all said the 90s should continue to be a decade for the Republicans. Because as you probably know, an interesting change has taken place. In 68, when I was the executive director of the Republican Party of Missouri, the Republicans were in third place. Most people were Democrats, second most were independents, third were Republicans. That's totally shifted now. First time in my lifetime, and all these pollsters were saying this. More American people identify themselves as Republicans, Democrats, and so forth. Each of these analysts said, you've got clear sailing with one caveat. How is the abortion issue going to play out in the next several election cycles? It's an emotional issue. You can't really discuss it the same way you can taxes or spending priorities or that sort of thing, because you don't get that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know the simple answer is that you got to define your position rather than letting your opponent define your position on an issue. But I think it's worth thinking about that in general terms, and Christians have to be aware of that. We could get beat badly on state levels and some of the state legislative races, some of the congressional races, if this thing is not handled properly, and you're going to be way back beyond where you were on the issue. Now, I don't know, but I think it's worth thinking about, and I agree with everything everybody said here today. The 20 years I've been in Washington, I've argued with more congressmen and senators about abortion than any other issue. What do you think?
Well, first of all, I appreciate your comments. I think they're right. In Missouri, this is absolutely not, or at least has not been heretofore, a partisan issue. I mean, the legislature's passed these, and the legislature in Missouri is 2-1 Democrat. So this has been absolutely bipartisan in nature, and not bound by any particular geography or demographics. It's been almost a universal. There does seem to be some alignment among parties on this issue. I think that's unfortunate, because I don't think this is or ever should be an issue which is bound to a particular political party. I do think people are scared of it, and they're scared of it because the American people are scared of it. They're squeamish about talking about it. And I think that brings us right back squarely into the realm of the fact that those in a position to educate others have an obligation to stand up and say, here's why you ought to think about it, and here's why you ought to think about it on a moral basis. Because ultimately it may not lend itself to legislatures. People may be so afraid that you'll have legislative gridlock, and that means ultimately it has to do with really what's in the hearts and minds of our people and our parishioners and what they think about the issue and what the children are taught about the issue. And that's why it really comes back a lot more to people in this room than perhaps even people down in the Missouri General Assembly or Congress. They may not have the will to act, but I think we should acknowledge if there is an implicit wrong here in abortions for convenience and gender selection and this genocide of one-third of all pregnancies, and if that's the case, as many believe it is, we have to come to grips with that ourselves.
I guess the bottom line is Christian people have no choice. They have to get involved in the political process.
You said it. Thanks a lot. Thank you all.
We're deeply grateful.